Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Late Night is off this week, but we hope you enjoy this exclusive conversation between Seth Meyers and comedian and writer Mike Birbiglia. They discuss their careers in comedy and Mike's one-man show, The New One, currently on Broadway. Now let's go to Seth Meyers and Mike Birbiglia.
Not only that, I was an intern at Conan.
Let's just start with that.
Yeah, let's start with that.
Hey, everybody, I like this. See, I've always wanted to start a podcast
where
it catches it.
Yeah, of course.
This is Mike Birbiglia.
This thing Kumail Nanjiani always makes fun of about podcasts.
Yeah.
The faux, just talking.
But this is genuine.
This is real.
But
real.
They don't know.
Yeah, they don't know.
They could. We could be faking it.
Yeah.
So, but you were an intern at Conan.
I was an intern at Conan, and I think it, in some ways people go like, well, what's like the, what's your big break, your most memorable thing? It's like, that was it. Like being an intern at like my favorite television show is bigger than like almost like being on Letterman.
That's fascinating.
If you scope it back.
I'm happy to hear that because obviously we have interns and we just were speaking.
Your assistant was
an intern on this show.
Yep, John.
I'm always worried that they're not getting an experience that they look back on and say, that was an incredibly formative moment in my life.
I can't speak for them.
Yeah.
But I think they might be. I think they might be is the answer.
That's good.
But the Conan interns, you know, it was John Krasinski and Mindy Kaling.
Oh, well,
and
this there was is like a whole different thing. Then.
Yeah, there was a whole, but that it wasn't like, that wasn't my semester, but like in that span of like 5 years, Ellie Kemper, there was like a, there was a chunk of people who made a career in show business.
I was an intern at Comedy Central.
Yeah, as was Mulaney.
I was in the on-air promotions department, and this would have been the summer of, I guess, 95. And it was disappointingly more busy work than I thought it would be. But again, and that's what you realize being an intern, I think, for a lot of people. But where were you placed?
So, like, I remember one day a task. Like, my task was I was in the control room.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Liz Plonka was the director. And there was a woman named Maureen. And there was, like, it was mostly women who worked in the control room. And they were pretty nice to me. They were overall pretty nice. I mostly just got coffee and I answered a phone. My whole deal was there was a phone.
Uh-huh.
And they said they were basically like, if it wasn't this name, but it was like, if Ron calls, get us immediately. And it was like, he never called. A whole summer, he never called. Like, I basically had no job.
See, a control room, though, is thrilling. That does feel
it feels like broadcast news.
Yeah, or my favorite year where you're in this building. And thrilling to be in 30 Rock and watching. Whereas I was in an office building. And it was great. The people I met at Comedy Central were really great. But it was a lot more of just copying tapes and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. So you did that when you were in college.
Yeah.
And then did it teach you anything? Because mine taught me a thing. But that was unrelated to what I did.
I was taught this at the end of my 10 weeks. My boss brought me in to give me his critique of my time there.
Yeah.
And he said, you started really good and then you got really bad. And it was really accurate.
Good note.
He said, yeah, I think
Johnny, take it down.
Yeah. Did you meet Conan when you were an intern?
You know, what's funny is they told us that when we did our orientation, they're like, don't talk to Conan, don't look at Conan. But this is their dangling a carrot. But if at the end of your tenure you want to schedule a meeting with Conan, he will talk to you.
Wow.
I got mono and had to leave abruptly.
Oh, man.
I never got the meeting.
We do a Q&A at the end in this room, where our podcast room. And Shoemaker and I sit here. Right
where you
we are.
Do?
Yeah, we do. We have all the interns.
Oh, that's
at the
cool.
End of their run. You were here for it, yes. And we let them ask anything. We feel it's more effective. And again, I think obviously Conan understood as well. Let them ask questions at the end as opposed
yeah,
to.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. But I learned a thing, which is I bugged the shit out of all the writers because all I wanted to be is a comedy writer.
Yeah.
You were similar. I know, being friends with you, that you wanted to just be a comedy writer. You didn't really want to be a performer.
No.
And then at a certain point, you're performing your comedy and you go, well, I do want it to be a certain way.
The
stuff I wrote. And so I asked Brian Stack, Brian McCann. I mean, it was like Murderers Row, John Glazer.
Yeah.
It was a really good writing staff. Smigel was coming in at that time doing the segments, the insult dog segments. And I would ask them all, like, what did you do to get here? And the answer always without fail was either I did improv in Chicago or I did stand up in New York. And so I went back to college, and I did stand-up and improv all the time.
And that was, so was that, you went back for your senior year as well? Was it between your junior year?
No, it was between my freshman and sophomore year.
You were an intern that young.
Yeah, so I went back, and I produced a sketch comedy show that actually Nick Kroll was in called The No Show. And I was actually pre-prepping it in the control room all summer. Because I had so much downtime, I was just writing and writing and writing. I wrote a whole sketch show and then I brought it back to campus.
And you, there was a Murderer's Row at Georgetown.
Apparently. We did not think that at the time.
You, Kroll, Mulaney, yep. Bradley Cooper.
Bradley Cooper. And then before me, and he came to the show, the person who cast me was James Murray from Impractical Jokers.
Wow.
Murr.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
He's the one who cast me. He and I had not bad blood for a while, but we had weird improv blood because a group of friends and I from the improv group that we were all in together with James, we broke off and formed a rival improv
sketch
team.
That's a big deal. That happens at a lot of colleges, and it's
ugly.
It's a tough bridge to get over.
And when James came to my show, the new one on Broadway, 48th and 6th Ave.
Oh, this recent is the
yeah, this
oh
is
my goodness.
This is fresh.
You
These are fresh wounds.
Okay.
So James Murray came. We hadn't seen each other in 20 years since basically we hadn't spoken since an improv duel.
Yep.
I'm not even kidding.
Yep. Sectarian improv.
And I said, I basically apologized. I don't know if I said I'm sorry, but I go like, hey, I just want you to know, like, when we formed the Regal Beagles.
Oh, man. What an indictment.
When we formed the Regal Beagles and I wasn't in the improv, your Georgetown Players anymore, I feel like there were some people who were hostile towards you, and I feel like in retrospect, I think you and I would have continued to be really good friends had that not happened, and that's partly my fault. And I don't know if I said I'm sorry, but it was close, and it was pretty reciprocal. I mean, it was like we actually. What's funny is but when you break friendships like 20 years ago, and it's kind of for no reason, you see the people again, you're like, oh, this person's cool.
Oh, of course, yeah. I feel like very few 20-year-old improv feuds. The hatred that was behind it would stand the test of time. Now I have to ask though, do either of those troops exist still?
Yeah, Georgetown Players Improv Group.
I knew it was going to be that one and not Regal Beagles. The one had a name to last.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so but I actually returned, after James graduated, I returned to be the director of the Georgetown Players improv group, and then I brought the Beagles back in.
Oh, I see. So you, I,
yeah, yeah, it's quite complex.
Unification. Yeah, you ran on a unification platform.
Yeah, yeah, unification ticket.
I was in my improv troupe in college, and I did not, I think I maybe told you this before, I didn't get in until my senior year. It was very,
wow.
There was only eight
slots.
That's very
competitive.
Very competitive.
Yeah.
And Pete Gross, you know Pete Gross?
Of course.
He and I both did not get in until our senior year.
Oh, no kidding. Even Pete didn't get in.
Even Pete,
wow.
So, but it was a big deal. I mean, there was a time in my life where that was by far the most important thing in my life was making it onto that improv troupe.
It's amazing how, and of course I made a movie about it because I'm so obsessed with improv. Like the dynamics of improv are fascinating to me.
Yeah.
They're endlessly fascinating because, you know, that movie is based on this thing which was at the Del Close Marathon like a few years ago. I was doing a show called Mike Birbiglia's Dream where I do monologues, and then it was like, you know, it was like Ellie Kemper and Aidy Bryant and all these people. And then there's people who haven't had that level of success, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but the key thing that was my wife Jen's observation is everyone is basically as funny as each other.
Yeah.
But then this person's super famous and successful, and this person's completely not. And not only not, but like, who knows if they'll even be doing comedy in 3 years from now. And I was like, holy cow, like that's a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like I totally saw that as like a big chill type movie, and that was sort of where it came from.
Yeah. I remember being at a bar after an improv show, and I always remember this about improv. And although I miss it, I also don't miss this part of it, which is we were complaining about something someone else on our improv troupe did, and a guy on our team came over with beers and said, you know, for every minute you complain about an improv show, you spend 1,000,000 years in hell.
That's so funny. Yeah, because it's the opposite of what improv is supposed to be.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be in the moment, whatever happened, happened.
And what's the point of complaining? It's the greatest waste of time to go back and say, but what I wanted them to do. Because it's not like working on a stand-up set where
you can go back the next night. And,
talking about stand-up. Look, I would also say there's probably better use of your time, but at least there's something you can get improved upon when you work on a stand-up set.
I got a bad reputation in my improv group in college for walking off stage and going, you f*** me.
Yeah.
I stopped doing that at a certain point.
I famously took off a baseball hat and threw it during an improv scene. And there's two terrible things to say there. One, that I lost my cool, and two, that I was improvising in a baseball hat. It's already shameful. This was the mid-90s. A lot of guys were wearing hats. So this is very exciting. You're doing a show on Broadway.
That is terrible.
It's terrible.
We should spend 5 minutes in silence after that story. That story has so much to unpack.
Just whipped it against the back of the...
Well, you know, the lore about Mulaney when I was... When I graduated, and then Nick Kroll, who I had cast in the improv group, cast Mulaney. And then I would come back, and he would go, like, you got to see this guy Mulaney. He's better than us. He's better than anybody. Literally. Yeah. He's better than anybody. And I would go, like, no, like, there's no way. And then I would see him, and he would be good. But the lore about, and then, of course, he became great, like one of the greats. The lore of him was that he would take over improv scenes and just do solo improv scenes. And I don't even know if that's true. I've never even asked him that. But that was his reputation.
That's really good lore.
Yeah, it's good lore.
I think I was a good improviser, but I know that my fault as an improviser was I always wanted to sketch write in real time, and I was really frustrated when people were doing different sketches.
Yeah, of course.
I just wanted... I remember once saying to Horatio... Admitting that. And we used to improvise on Sundays and do
Of course, ask that, yeah.
And I remember once admitting to Horatio at work, you know, I feel as though I have really good, like when I walk out on stage, I want my scene partner to like listen and try to guess where I'm going because I have really good initiative.
That's so funny.
And it, of course, absolute wrong person to tell.
Oh my God.
So literally the next
time.
He's
so loose.
Yeah.
Not only is he loose, but he intentionally destroys people's premises as a goof.
And that was what happened. The next time we did a scene, somebody finishes a monologue. I walk out and, you know, pull up a chair and I'm like, take a seat.
Yeah.
I was like, take a seat, Dan. I have to tell you something. And he immediately said, I am going to do that, but there is a wolf man in the lobby. And it was
knowing
that he had just been waiting until the next time that I was cocky.
There's a wolf man in the lobby. That's great. All right.
Yeah, that coffee just came in.
I am thrilled to take advantage. Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to take advantage of that. I was an intern and got coffee for so many people.
Yeah,
here.
And that you just got one here.
And I just got it here. I've made it.
You mentioned Mulaney. Mulaney is the one who told you to do this show in Butter, right? Or tried to convince you to do it.
Him and Berkowitz, my agent. Those are the two people. I was not for it going to Broadway.
Interesting. What was your hesitation?
Neither was my wife. Neither was my brother. Like the people who are like in my close circle. There's something about, like, I've been doing these off-Broadway shows. You came to the off-Broadway shows. Like, I have a good niche. Like, I have a thing where I go off-Broadway and people show up and it's not that stressful. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
It's enjoyable because people have just, it was stressful the first time for Sleepwalk with me because I'd never done it. But after that, people were like, no, he's good at this. We'll go and it'll be good. And then with Broadway, it was like, oh my God, that's so stressful. It's so expensive. Someone's going to have to put up $2 million. You know, like I'm going to be beholden to all these investors for the rest of time. Like it just seems scary.
Yeah.
And Mulaney and Berkowitz were two people who were just like, no, it's like this show belongs there because what it's about, it's a universal.
Yes.
And Broadway is all about universals.
Yeah.
Like your other shows, like Sleepwalk With Me, it's a little niche. Girlfriend's Boyfriend Even is a little bit of a niche about marriage. And Thank God for Jokes is a niche about people who are sort of obsessed with jokes and that idea. They're like, this is about you're about having a kid. It's literally the most mainstream thing you'll ever do,
yeah.
Potentially.
Obviously, you prepared for it the way you'd prepare for an off-Broadway show and that you go out on the road and you do it in different places. So was that exactly the same prep? Or were there times when you're out on stage on the road where you're thinking, oh, I have to do this a little differently because I have to remember this is going to be a Broadway show, not an off-Broadway show? Or in the end, is it just the venue is different, not you or your performance style?
It was a little different because like I did like Berklee Repertory Theater for a month last summer. You know, like I did La Jolla Playhouse for like 2 weeks. Like I did the circuit of when shows are prepping for Broadway.
I see.
A little bit. I did Two River in New Jersey. Like which I'm going to do again. Like my experience with those was like, oh, these are great theaters.
And I must be nice then as well to do the same venue multiple nights.
Yes.
Then you don't think, oh, that's a joke. That joke worked in Milwaukee at this size,
yes.
But wouldn't work at San Francisco at that size. I mean, that...
It's funny you should say Milwaukee because Rock came the other day, which is thrilling. I mean, you and I are probably...
Dwayne the Rock Johnson, right? Well, there's two, so I think you need to be specific.
Oh, are there just two?
They're just...
So Chris Rock came and which is just thrilling. And I don't care if he hears it, if he listens to the pod, and then I'm less cool.
I think he would be angrier if you
did. Okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it never won't be cool for Chris Rock to come to my show.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it never, that never will wear off.
No, definitely not.
I mean, the last special is phenomenal, Tambourine, but like, Bigger and Blacker and Bring the Pain back to back. We're in such a seminal period of my like comedy growth. They're just imprinted in my brain.
Yeah.
And so he came and he said an interesting thing that mentioned Milwaukee. He goes, I don't know if I'd do this like for a long time, like you were like the way Springsteen did it, because I think it is important to go to Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
Like it is important to go out and be in the places and live the life that the locals live and understand it. And I agree. I mean, I did this in 60 cities.
Yeah, but that's the thing. You did what
did
you
both.
Also did.
I did
what,
both
yeah.
of the things.
It's just this was the culmination of both,
yeah.
Which seems great. Also, do you ever feel like you live in the city when you go to Milwaukee?
It varies. It varies. I try to. I mean, I always find like if you can just convince yourself to get out of the hotel and do one damn thing. Like we were in Boise and we were basically like asked like what's a cool thing to go to if there's 2 hours, and they told us about this military reserve that like is on a mountain and like overlooks the city, and it was like mind bending.
Oh, it was great.
It's great.
You know, I don't go on the road that much, but when I do, I tend to spend the entire day in the hotel just thinking about what I'm going to do that night.
Yeah.
Because it's just so rare. And again, this goes back to the universal idea of having children and being married. You just to have a day to think about it is so valuable that it would have to be an exceptional view for me to have to give up however many hours it
would be. So what do you do in the day you're just in the hotel thinking about what's going to happen after the show?
No. I'm like writing. Just trying, you know, because then I'm not out all the time. So when I go out, I want to try new things and I want to refamiliarize myself. I just feel like I'm just...
On stage.
Yes, I want to try new things, let's say. So it's about like using that time to fine tune, I guess.
I think you and I are going to do the Natural Resources Defense Council event again.
Yeah, this was a very interesting gig we did.
Yeah.
We were booked to do the Natural Resources Defense Council stand-up night the night after the 2016 election.
Which was a pretty run-of-the-mill election. I don't know if anyone's listening who caught that one. It's sort of like your sort of standard Republican, your standard Democratic candidate.
The idea was no matter who won, the crowd would be exactly the same. The pro-environment Manhattan crowd would be the exact. It was, there are jokes about bad rooms. There was some catharsis. I don't think we all bombed or anything.
It was as though the earth had died.
Yeah.
And we were at a funeral for the earth.
Yeah.
At the Natural Resources Defense Council, who had spent its entire life working so that the earth wouldn't die.
Yeah. And there was a video. They did a video of all the animals that were going to die. It was one of those. It was basically they did the Oscar in memorial, but for animals that were still with us but about to die.
Yeah.
And then we had to go up. Yumi, Oliver.
Yep. John Oliver.
John Oliver. George Lopez.
George Lopez.
And I can't remember, but...
A young comedian named Hasan Minhaj.
You're right.
Yep.
That was the first time I ever met him. But you know what I remember about that night, which was really nice? And we all were sort of going up and talking about what had happened.
Yeah.
As you would do as a comedian. And I remember watching you, and you sort of then shifted into that really great bit you have about your wife being late.
Late for yoga class.
Late
for
yoga. And I realized, I was like, oh, that's what everybody wants.
Oh, they were, yeah.
They actually don't want to hear how bad last night was. They want to hear a story about someone else's.
That's the catharsis of doing this show right now.
Yeah.
No political references.
Yeah.
It's just about being alive. And it's dark. Don't get me wrong. Like the show, the first half of the show is this elaborate argument for why no one should ever have a child.
Yeah.
Which is how I had always felt before having a child. And the second half is, I had a child. Here's why I was right. And the end of it ultimately turns on itself in a way that is I for some people uplifting. So, I scrubbed it of political references. I used to have a Trump joke. It actually did really well.
Yeah.
It was an applause line. Like I was just like, no, I'd like to actually let these people have a night where they don't think about Trump and remember that they're alive.
Yes. And the problems you address and problems of parenthood and that sort of thing, I think are, you know, it doesn't really matter who's in office.
Yeah.
Like you would be thinking the same way about your current situation if Hillary Clinton was president.
Yeah. Yeah, although lately.
Yeah, that's true. As I'm saying this, I'm like, I don't know. Because I do, I will say that a thing about having kids that is, before I had kids, I thought I would make it until the planet burned up. Like I was going to get out in time.
Yeah.
And now for the first, it's such a bummer because I feel as though I've added 40 years of caring about if the Earth is going to make it. Because I had a kid and now it's got to be his lifetime too. Their lifetime. There's two of them now.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. And it's not the same dilemma that I feel like once worried about.
Yeah.
I feel like the current dilemma is like, what's going to happen with the Earth?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's like a chunk of people who are like, no, that's not the dilemma. And you're like, no, it yeah, actually like, is.
Well, you just realize it's too big, I think, for people to.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah. There's no special counsel to stop the Earth that you can just say, they got it. Don't worry. We can just wait for Mueller's going to come up with a way to stop global warming.
Yeah, yeah,
It's just wait. He's got it.
There's a lot of couples that come to the show because they just had a kid.
Of course.
People are like, this is the show for you.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a couple in the third row, and they were both of them dead asleep.
Wow.
Dead asleep. I've never seen that. In my career, I've had many times where there's one person who's asleep. You know, people have narcolepsy, there's issues. Sometimes I'm very boring. But this was two people together asleep. And In earlier in my career, I would have called it out. I would have made a thing of it. In this case, I was like, I get it.
Yep.
I'm on a different side of it.
Sure.
Like, I'm on the parenting side now, and I'm like, I see two parents asleep in the audience, and that they're like, yeah, I've totally been there.
How much of the audience can you see?
Oh, are you saying they might all be asleep?
Well, I'm just saying you said it was the only two, and I would just say you should see. What percentage do you see, and then extrapolate it out, and that's probably a better...
So 14% of the audience is asleep. I did the calculations. And no, I actually see at different parts of the show 5, 6, 7 rows back.
Do you like, when you do stand up, what do you like?
I like darkness usually.
Yeah.
But with this show, it's very intimate. And so I actually enjoy seeing them.
Right.
I enjoy like, and that's actually weirdly like part of, I mean, I'm doing 100 performances. So it's like, that's part of what keeps it interesting for me is I keep making tweaks in the show and cuts and adds and tweaks. But also, like, the audience is a character in the show. Like, the different audience every night, and it's a different show.
Yeah.
It feels like a different show. And that was the thing that, when I was it was funny, I was sort of a momentous thing this week, which is I've met Seinfeld since I moved to New York almost 20 years ago, probably about 100 times.
Mm-hmm.
And the other night, he met me. And we were doing a benefit for the David Lynch Foundation, and he watched my set, and he was nice. He was, like, friendly, and he said, is that in the show? You know, like, is that in the Broadway show? And I was like, yeah. And I told him, because, again, similar to Chris Rock, like, I'm such a big fan. It's like, I'm not going to pretend to be cool in front of Jerry Seinfeld.
Right.
I said to him, like, when I was on the road starting out, I would listen to the On Comedy CD in my mom's Volvo station wagon on a loop, interviewing you, talking about comedy. So, like, in a lot of ways, like, you were a professor, you were like my comedy professor, because at the time there weren't podcasts and there weren't comedy classes, there weren't anything. So you're just, that's like all you have is these like random CDs and of interviews, and he says a thing that I repeated to him, and I go two things I always repeat that you say, one on the CD, which is, one is that the audience is your scene partner, and then that's always different, and it's unpredictable. As though it's a play, that they're your scene partner. And the other thing is that the audience tells you what's funny about you.
Yeah.
And I've always repeated that to young comics. Because I feel like it's always this thing that it literally takes years to understand that. And Seinfeld goes like, I was just saying that in an interview this morning. He's like, I was saying, like, half of the stuff I say on stage is just stuff that the audience liked a lot. And I go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'll talk about that more.
Yeah. It is incredible to have, I mean, again, I think it's what gets you to go out is not just that you want to hear what people like about you.
Yeah.
And that you don't fully know.
And don't like about you and are just like provoked by, like Pete Holmes quoted a thing from Seinfeld recently where he goes like your comedy has to match your face.
Yeah.
Like what you like, literally what you look like.
Uh-huh.
And if it doesn't, it's weird.
Yeah.
Like if you don't get what you look like, it's weird.
It's so funny because I used to think it was that weird thing when so many comedians would come out and the first thing they do is make a joke about
their appearance.
Their appearance.
Yeah.
But then you realize, I'd never realized the importance that they are telling the audience, I also know how.
That was all of my early career was jokes about my last name being Birbiglia. It's such a stupid long name. And I'd have like 15 jokes about it.
And so
and then we'd move on.
And then they've been, and the audience knows you know, and they're very happy. They're like, okay, good.
What was your opening? Like, what did you used to, because now you don't need it because your opening is your Seth Meyers.
Yeah. That's a better opening than
I'm from TV. Nice to meet you.
I ever had.
Well, you'd have to hand over the show to me.
Oh, is that why this came up? Oh, my God.
I just thought of it.
This is I just thought of it. You have a notepad in front of you, and it's written out.
You're right. It says me host.
It says me host, and it's so the grammar is so bad, I have no idea what it meant.
Your job, I don't want your job. Your job is too hard. Your job is literally too hard for me to do.
But it's easier than SNL.
Is it really?
I think it might be.
So that was harder.
This is hard. Don't get me wrong. But it's the exact. It's the same every. There has a sameness to it and a control to it that wasn't at SNL.
Yeah.
I feel like this is, you know, at this job, you have to learn how to be a helicopter pilot, whereas at SNL, you don't know what kind of ship you were pilot. Every week, you'd be like,
yeah,
you would
yeah,
go
yeah.
to helicopter pilot school, and then you'd show up, and they'd be like, it's submarine. You'd say, oh, submarine. And then you'd have a week to figure out how to do submarine.
Wow. You know what felt like that was when Mulaney hosted and they did the lobster sketch. It felt like, wow, they really learned this.
Yeah.
Like, holy cow.
But then that's because they had written that
years ago.
But that's an interesting thing because the week they wrote it, a helicopter wasn't hosting. You know what I mean? It was submarine week, and so it didn't go. And so.
That's right. So this is what I wrote down under me host.
You did write me first guest.
Yeah, yeah. Me first guest. That's my actual goal. I want to be first guest on Seth Meyers. I'm planting a seed.
I think we can make that happen.
I just want to get out of that second guest category. So yeah. People go, wait, who's this? Who's his first guest?
Who's his first guest?
It's
Broadway's Mike Birbiglia.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Has that started happening yet? Are you Broadway Mike'd anyone? Is that?
That nickname has not stuck, no. But I do think, the recognizing, like, complete and total strangers recognize me as more.
Even though you've toured it to get it ready for this.
Yeah.
Broadway shows tour, obviously. Will there be a second on the road of this?
I think there might be.
I think there will be, too. And that's great.
It seems like, yeah. And it seems like it may go some cool and fancy places.
Well, there's something exciting about a Broadway show coming through town.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also it's better than it's when show one. Like,
yeah.
show 100 is going to be far better than show one. That's the thing that's crazy about running it in the same exact space for so long. You really can hone it.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I'm very jealous about that.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think
Do you think you'll do that ever?
I don't know. But I like the idea of doing the same thing. I appreciate how much better and how exciting it must be to feel it getting better.
Yeah.
Because even though I feel like this show obviously has gotten better the more we do it, it's not that thing of the same, finding a different way to say a joke or anything.
You probably never want to put out like a comedy special because it'll burn that material, right?
Yeah, but I might one day want to do it just because at this point I don't know how much more I can go on the road, so I might as well burn it.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. Burning it feels as though it's not great material. You know, I feel like there's a comic way we talk about it, but it's like, I just want to burn it.
Right.
Please enjoy.
Right. Totally. I would like to see you do an hour. I want to see your kid... you had a two kids hour.
Yeah. I have good... I mean, again...
You do it in the warm-up, probably.
Not that... I do a Q&A with the audience, and it comes up a fair amount.
Yeah.
And I like talking about
it. You always tell that story about the elevator?
I do on stage.
It's a great story.
Because there's a good... There's more... You know, telling it on the show is obviously great, but now, of course, there's more to it. It's like sort of the post-mortem.
Yeah, you could probably do like 25 on that.
I said to my wife, you gave me something better than a child. You gave me 10 minutes.
That's ridiculous.
For real. And this is a true story. That happened, and on the way out the door, the last fireman out passed me and said, I guess you got your monologue.
Yeah, there you go.
And I realized, that's like, nice. even the firemen know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How lucky I am.
Everyone's in. Everyone's in on it.
Thank you for doing this.
Of course.
Thanks, buddy. It's always great to
thanks
talk to you.
Lot.
And I'll see you tonight.
I'll see you tonight. I got some Whoppers.
No, okay.
I don't know. We'll see.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.